Ochilan Kutash beckoned. Moist knew it as a likeable kind of place, a little market town with the usual hinterland of farmers and lumberjacks, some mining too, dwarfs and humans, quite often these days working on the same mine and even the same seams. It was big enough to have a mare and sensible enough to have a very good tavern called the Fiddler's Riddle, and apparently it was a place where the current unpleasantness had not yet reached. What Moist hadn't expected to find as they pulled up to the platform just past midnight was the brass band and the flags and the Morris dancing and the funfair, which it appeared had been organised to welcome the first proper train to arrive at the newly constructed station and had been going on for hours. And as soon as Eingerda came to a stop with her last hiss, Mr. Skiller, the landlord of the Fiddler's Riddle, who turned out also to be the town mayor, began an address, offering the freedom of his little town to everyone on the train. Although, of course, it wasn't a little town, oh, indeed not, to its mayor. It was chasing Ankh Morpork. A little part of Moist's brain laid a bet with itself that very shortly the words "on the map" were going to be uttered. And indeed the mayor, large and florid as a proper mayor should be, said, as Moist stepped down, minding the gap, "This will put Ochilan Kutash on the map, and no mistake. We're already breaking ground for a much bigger tavern with facilities." He looked at Moist solemnly and said, "You have to have facilities these days, you know. We paid for our own Clax Tower. We're very modern here, that's for sure." Moist looked around at the cobbled town square that lay a short distance from the platform. It would have been better if it hadn't been the middle of the night, but the mayor saw no problem with this, and cheerfully pointed out to the now clustering passengers the locations of the wonderful things that they would be able to see when it was daylight. And it nearly broke Moist's heart to say to the man, "I'm afraid we have to go very soon, schedules, you know." And indeed he could see the water crane pumping and could hear the rattle of the coal being delivered to the engine, but nothing could stop the mayor in his rampant hospitality. "But we've arranged for a mayoral banquet." "Will you excuse me for a moment, Mr. Mayor?" Moist had a private word with Simnel about arrangements for the next leg of the journey, and then with Vimes, who nodded and said quietly, "Sensible. I wouldn't mind eating off a plate that wasn't rattling. There's no harm in pandering to a little civic pride. The mayor is a decent cove, and they've got a watch of sorts. Two watchmen, not too bad in these circumstances, and I know that because I trained them." Moist came back to the reception committee, put his arm around the ebullient, red-faced mayor, and said, "Well, sir, I'm sure we can spare the time for a modest banquet before the dreadful pressures of the timetable force us onwards." They left Simnel at the station with his fellow engineers to await the arrival of the backup flyer, which had left Zemphis a few hours after Eingerda. The King and Aaron remained ensconced on the train, safely guarded in the armoured carriage, busy with paperwork and plans for their arrival in Uberwald. The rest of the party followed the mayor across the square to his hostelry. The town really had tried. Something about the mayor's conviction that the world revolved around their town, or would do if it ever came there, had dribbled into the minds of his ratepayers, who now set to warming up marvellous dishes they had expected to be serving several hours before, and were very understanding, especially after Moist's description of the fight along the Paps. Admittedly, he had put a certain amount of shine on the episode. Surely that was what shine was for. And it permeated, even into the consciousness of those who had travelled, and at one point, of the twilight, the darkness actually stood up and made a bow. And Moist couldn't help himself and pointed at the goblin, saying, "Of the twilight, the darkness and his gallant fellows fought alongside Commander Vimes with great courage." And then Moist glanced at the commander, who puffed his cigar and said, "Excellent fighters, to a goblin." "Oh, we like goblins," said the mayor. "They run our Clax Tower. And do you know, the snail infestation in my paracious sprouter patch has completely gone since they moved in." And there was another toast to the Clax at this point, with a side order of goblins. By the time they had all processed back to Eingerda, she had been covered with petals by the virgins of the town. Well, at least, they said they were virgins. There certainly were petals. The flyer had been and gone some time before, with its crew of engineers, supplemented by cheery Littlebottom, once more playing decoy, and other good fighters. It was, even now, on the track to Slake, acting as a pathfinder for Eingerda to confuse the enemy. As Eingerda steamed out of Ochilan Kutash, most people headed off to sleep. Moist had loaned the sleeping compartment assigned to him to two of those wounded in the battle, and was now bunking down in the guard's van, comfortable enough when you were dog-tired and detritus wasn't snoring. All Moist's life he'd managed to find a way of sleeping in just about every circumstance, and besides, the guard's van was somehow the hub of the train, and although he didn't know how, he did it. He always managed to sleep, with half of one ear open. And now he savoured the familiar sounds of the journey, the rocking soothing him right up until somewhere down the line when he was catapulted into the real world by the screech once more of the locomotive's wheels in distress and the squealing of brakes in torment. It was still dark outside. Moist drowsily stumbled across the flatbed as doors were being opened and feet were running in the carriage ahead, and reached the armoured compartment of the King. It was empty. There was a dwarf guard who said, "The King went on to footplate." The dwarf looked ashamed. "I tried to persuade him to let me go with him, but what can he do? He is the King." Moist said, "Don't worry. Just keep this station. I'll go and see what's happening." There was a drill for this, he knew. And where was the King? That was the trouble with royalty. However decent they were, and understanding, they were also likely to think that such things as security arrangements were for other people. Frantically searching, Moist finally dropped down onto the track and ran along to the engine, where he found the King talking to Dick Simnel on the footplate and getting covered in smuts. Pale flames were visible ahead, on the track, and Simnel's expression was grave. "It were just as well the King were here, because the decoy flyer has been derailed ahead of us, and so would we have been if it weren't for him. He can see it dark." "Ah, Commander Vimes," said the King to Vimes, who had arrived at speed, "you should know about the dark accustomed eye if any human does. There's a long straight ahead, and Dick hadn't seen the derailment, but I did just in time. Now, there may be injured people up there." And then the King was running towards the flames, adopting the traditional dwarf strategy of running at the enemy with as much weaponry as you could swing. But Vimes caught up with him and rolled him to the ground just as an explosion rattled the trees and bounced off the mountains. The flyer's boiler had blown up. Ahead of them now was just a warm mist and the occasional clink of stricken metal. Vimes got the King upright and said, "Apologies for the lays, Majesty, although you must know that we Vimeses have gone a lot further than that in the past. You should have listened. The old deal for the crew of the decoy flyer was to run away as fast as possible if attacked, but not before making sure that the emergency bung in the boiler was strapped right down." "Ah, yes, Blackboard Monitor, how easily we revert to type in an emergency. I'm sorry to have put you to extra trouble." "That'll teach the boogers a lesson," said Dick, panting as he caught up with them. "They'll think twice about messing with one of my engines again." The crew of the flyer were up a little gully, into which they had dived for shelter. It had once been home to frogs. Regrettably, it still was, and several of the designated bodyguards rose from the little swamp with nothing more than torn clothing and a lot of mud, some of which was hopping. But Cheery Littlebottom was as cheery as her name suggested. There seemed to be no grags, but even as Moist looked around, an arm dropped out of a tree, still holding a club in an iron grip. And hereabouts, if you cared to look, and frankly nobody cared to do so but did nonetheless, there were several signs that grags and delvers, and many others of the dark underworld, had passed away in this spot, resting at peace and, thanks to the exploding boiler, in pieces. Detritus appeared out of the gloom, saying, "One or two of them was still out there. Not any more." He slammed down a breastplate with a resounding clang. "You all right, lads?" said Simnel to the engineers. "Shame about the flyer. It hurts killing a locomotive, and it means we've not got either a pathfinder or a backup engine no more. We need to clear the track now, and then we'll pick up the scrap when we come back to go towards a new flyer. After all, we're getting reet good at building these things. But any bits of micromail you find, like this here," he pointed at the arm holding the axe, "I'll have now, mind. Call it tit for tat. It'll be another trophy for Iron Girder." In the grey light of dawn, the trolls made quick work of clearing the track ahead. As Moist watched, he suddenly saw creatures moving in the shadows, and then a sad little voice in the vicinity of his foot said, "Please don't hurt us, please. We live here. We're gnomes. We're cobblers. It's what we do in these woods. We make charcoal and other things for sale, turned wood, excellent wooden furniture, and we try not to be in anyone's way. But the dwarfs have been marching. We think that bad times are coming again, and we're scared." There was a sigh. Then the voice went on.
You must know it's the little people who are the last to be thought of when great tribes go to war. My name is Slam. I'm the speaker for all the rest who are hiding in these hills because we know how to hide. It's a skill we've perfected over the years. May we be of assistance?
Gnomes, said the king at Moist's side. I haven't heard of them for ages. There used to be a lot of them, once upon a time. And Moist thought, yes, these are the little people who get trodden on and left behind like the goblins. If they had a cheeky champion like Of the Twilight the Darkness or Tears of the Mushroom and a Wonderful Harp, they'd become known gnomes. But the face of Slam suggested to him that the gnomes had been through the mill and come out as a very fine grist, and had been content to slip into obscurity, and somehow were now drifting into a kind of sad oblivion. He realised that the king was staring at the spokes gnome. Rhys said, I knew you were around here in the forests. What can I do for you?
You could leave us alone, Your Majesty. Your absence. That's what everybody needs, to be left alone. Left alone to get on with their lives, and indeed, said the little gnome more sharply, to be allowed to live at all.
The king stepped back along the track and put one hand on Iron Girder, still spluttering and steaming, and, like somebody taking an oath, which he possibly was, said, I've known of you people since my childhood, and right now, boyo, you may live as you like in these woodlands, and I'll be the first to defend your right to do so. He looked around at the rest of the crew and said, We must continue. There's still a lot of miles between here and Uberwald. Dick, who had been in an urgent conversation with Wally by the water tender, grimaced. I'm sorry, Your Majesty, but we've got a problem. There were a depot here for coal and water, but it's been smashed, and the Grags have smashed the water crane and emptied water. We've still got coal, but we've barely got enough water to go to the next depot. The engine can't run without water. We need to refill tank. He paused. Come to think of it, where are railway folk? The way I reckons the schedules, there should have been people here already and waiting for us. Slam cleared his throat.
We heard noises. People fighting.
Moist looked at Vimes meaningfully, and the commander said, Detritus, think you could find them? The watchman saluted.
Me and Blue John will go looking. We are good at finding humans. It's a troll thing. We'll find them, dead or alive.
The two trolls headed into the undergrowth, and Moist was sensitive to the fact that a large amount of firepower had gone with them. The commander looked grim. The little gnome by Moist's feet tugged at his trouser leg to get attention.
We can help with the water, he said. There's a good spring behind the rise, and there's hundreds of us, and it's not far, and we make excellent buckets, and I reckon we can fill your tanks in an hour or so.
And they did. Slam brought out a whistle from his jacket and blew it, and about 100 replicas of the little gnome appeared. Not walked up, not came out of the sky, not came out of the earth. Simply appeared, each one carrying 2 buckets. It was evident that, small as they were, the gnomes were tough. Simnel watched them dashing away to the tender and back again, looking very carefully at their boots, massive things.
Hey, oh, Mr. Gnome, do you make them boots? I'm not being funny, but they are the biggest boots I've ever seen on such little folk. And, you know, with all the walking on lines and cinders and all, our boots wear out too damn quickly. I mean, look at these, worn in all weathers. You said you were cobblers. Can you work metal and all? Because if you can, what we really need are lads who can make heavy boots for railway workers. I'd be dead chuffed if you could. Boots for lads on permanent way have got to be permanent boots.
Slam beamed.
If someone could send us the specifications as soon as possible, we'll send a sample. And for your interest, Mr. Engineer, we are not little folk. We are big on the inside.
He was interrupted by Detritus, coming through the undergrowth like a creature from the dawn of time, followed by Blue John in his role as heavy weapon. Blue John carefully put down 2 corpses and a mangled water crane. Rhys Reeson swore when he saw the corpses, and young Simnel wept, but it was now fully morning and time was passing. After a quick consultation with Commander Vimes and the Low King, the decision was made to leave. As everyone reboarded the train, Moist and Simnel said farewell to the gnomes.
"'Please look after this place and give these gentlemen a decent burial with a stone,' said the red-eyed Simnel. "'And if possible, can you do out with water crane?'
Slam beamed again.
"'It's only metal. Didn't I mention that we're dinkers as well? We can definitely fix it for you.'
"'Well, then,' said Moist, "'you and your people are now working for the railway, and that means you are working for Harry King, and Sir Harry doesn't like anything bad to happen to his employees. Oh, my word, yes.' You'll see trains a lot in the future, and I think you'll find your lives considerably more busy. I'll send a clax to Sir Harry about remuneration.
"What's remuneration?"
said the little tinker. Moist said, "You'll find out." As Iron Girder struck out for Slake, the gnomes lined up and waved tiny little handkerchiefs until long after the train was out of sight. Fishing for carp in Lake Overshot that afternoon, Mr. Geoffrey Indigo was quietly surprised when the water in the lake simply disappeared in a certain amount of bubbling, leaving some gasping fish, startled frogs, and a rather attractive nymph, who was very angry and spat at him as if it was his fault. But the man who had written that well-known book, Out With My Flies in All Weathers, kept his calm and made a note to mention this phenomenon at the next meeting of the Overshot Fishing Society. As he meticulously cleaned his gear and generally tied it up, he heard a liquid noise and was surprised for a second time to see that the hole in the landscape was now refilling with water. He watched, amazed, as the nymph spat at him again, leaving him feeling somewhat wronged. And on the way home, squelching a little, he wondered if anyone would believe him. When he told his wife later about the strange day, she snorted. "Geoffrey, you really shouldn't take your brandy flask with you."
"I didn't take it with me," he protested. "It's still on the sideboard where it always is."
"Then just don't tell anybody," his wife concluded. "People think you're strange and we can't have that." Geoffrey, the least strange person in the world, except possibly when it came to talking about fish, decided not to say anything. After all, you didn't want to become a laughingstock. Moist was starting to worry about Dick Simnel and his band of overworked engineers. What sleep they got was in sleeping bags, curled up on carriage seats. Eating, but not eating well, just driven by their watches and their desire to keep the train going. If you met them away from the cab, their conversation was about gears and wheels and timings, but it was clear to Moist that they were frazzled after days of living on the footplate and wrestling their locomotives through various little tantrums. And so he confronted Mr. Simnel, saying, "Surely we can afford to slacken pace a little and let you and your lads get your heads down for a bit. As far as I can see, we're well on schedule." And he detected, in Dick's eyes, not madness, but something else more subtle. He was sure it had no name. It seemed to be a sort of hunger for anything that was new, and above all for proving that something could be refined to the point of perfection and kept there. In the goblins, this was endemic, although it didn't seem to do them much harm. Humans, apparently, were another matter. "People are going to die if we push them any further," he said to Dick. "You lot would rather work than sleep. I swear, sometimes you seem to be as mechanical as Iron Girder, and that's not right. You have to chill. Get laid back before you are laid back and laid down forever." To Moist's amazement, Dick suddenly ripped out at him like a lion. He could almost hear the growl. "Who are you to talk, Mr. Moist? What have you made, built, fretted over? I see none of your fingernails are torn, and you can talk well in a fancy way, but what is it you've made? What is it you are?"
"Me, Dick? Well, now I come to look at it, I'm the grease that turns the wheels and changes minds and moves the world along. Or you might say that I'm a kind of a cook, but it is a special kind of cookery. It's a bit like the sliding rule. You just move things about at the right time and you get the answer you need. In short, Dick, I make things happen, and that includes your railway."
The young man swayed in front of him, and Moist's tone became gentle. "And I now see that part of my job is to tell you that you need some rest. You've run out of steam, Dick. Look, we're well on the way to Uberwald now, and while it's daylight, and we're out of the mountains, and it's going to be the least risky time to run with minimum crew, we're all going to need our wits about us when we get near the pass. Surely you can take some rest." Simnel blinked, as if he'd not seen Moist the first time, and said, "Yes, you're right." And Moist could hear the slurring in the young man's speech, caught him before he fell, and dragged him into a sleeping compartment, put him to bed, and noted that the engineer didn't so much fall asleep as somehow flow into it. And, that job done, he went to the guard's van where Vimes was drinking coffee and carefully going through the paperwork relating to the captive delvers, who in the pinch sang like most canaries. "Commander Vimes, can you help me a moment?"
"Problem, Mr. Litvig.
The lads are working all the time, and they seem to think it's the badge of a man never to go to sleep.
I have to teach that to young coppers. Treasure a night's rest, I always say. Take a nap whenever you can."
"Very good," said Moist. "Now, look at them here. Still working on the sliding rules and fretting themselves because they've spent too much time trying to put one over on the universe." "It seems like that," said Vimes, getting up. Together they wandered along the train, forcing the engineers to at least lie down in their bunks or face the wrath of Sir Harry King. And in a few cases, Moist suggested of the Twilight the Darkness should dose them with one of his harmless little potions. Not all of them, of course, in case there was an emergency. You never knew when you might need an engineer. In his cell, Albrecht Albrechtson had had plenty of time to consider Ardent's tactics. Ardent was a mere stripling youth. A dwarf is not thought of as a youth until he is in his 50s. But was already revealed as a manipulative chancer, seeking advancement come what may and by any means he deemed necessary. He wormed his way into everything, and in that sentence, Albrecht thought the important word was worm. Being Ardent's prisoner was galling. The food was good, and drink likewise, even if the small beer was smaller than he'd have liked. He was allowed some of his books, too, apart from those Ardent considered undwarfish, a terminology that told you everything about the arrogant young upstart, still wet behind the helmet, who was no doubt keen to get his paws on the whole of Schmalzberg, undwarfish fat mines and all. And in his little dungeon, Albrechtson had to endure Ardent's self-serving philosophy about the role of the Low King. What insolence! Lecturing him, the foremost scholar on the subject. But it didn't do to get angry, at least not yet. Anger was a weapon to be honed and treasured and used only at the moment yielding most premium. And that thought was followed by a noise on the stone stairs as the pompous fool came again to get him to change his mind. Of course, Ardent would begin as if he was just an old friend coming to chew the rat, but as he talked, Albrechtson would glimpse the coils of a decent mind unfolding. After all, he was opposing his sovereign, something not done lightly, if ever. Ardent had to be aware of the penalty for those who took up arms against the Low King. Despite everything, there must have been a good mind there, one which could have been useful to dwarf kind as a whole, and might yet be useful, even if, right now, it couldn't tell pyrites from gold. It was no secret that the most highly balanced minds sometimes, well, overbalanced. The key turned in the lock. There was Ardent, and his expression seriously frightened his erstwhile mentor. You needed to be mature to sense this sort of thing, but you could tell in a person's eyes if they were being driven by an idea. They had a clammy look about them, and so did Ardent. Nevertheless, Albrechtson laid down his pen and said in a calm voice, "So kind of you to come and see me. I understand the king will be here shortly, courtesy of the train. Won't that be nice?" There was a little bloom of spittle on one side of Ardent's face, and he snapped, "You can't possibly know that." Albrechtson sat back convivially and said, "It's probably true that I taught you all you know, young dwarf, but I did not teach you all I know. I have some skills that I didn't impart." "Then they must include guesswork. I hold the key to information in Schmalzberg. No Clax Towers are standing."
"Oh yes, so I hear."
"Rhys Reason is betraying all that is dwarfish, and for the sake of our species you surely know that I must take the scone of stone. The majority of the dwarfs here are behind me."
Albrechtson twiddled a pen in his fingers and said,
"Possibly in order not to have to look at your face, Ardent. You're shaken, and the courage of your convictions will see you convicted the moment the king steps into Schmalzberg. From what I know of Rhys Reason, he may be merciful."
"Yes, I thought you'd say something like that, but the deed is done."
Albrechtson looked stunned.
"You've actually taken the scone."
For a moment, Ardent looked foxed.
"Not as such. Everything is in place. It only needs me to take the final step and Rhys Reason can have a retirement somewhere out of the way, like back in Chlamydos."
"Then do it now. Go on. There's nothing to stop you, is there? But the Low King is elected, isn't he? How certain are you? How certain are you that all your fellow travellers are stalwart? Because I'm absolutely certain that many of them are not. Oh, yes, they fawn on you and promise a lot. But as the train comes closer and we hear the whistle of change blowing, I think you'll find that suddenly they have other engagements and recall never talking to you about the scone of stone. That's happening now and you don't know it."
It was unfair, really. Ardent said, "I invite you to remember that you're locked in here and I have the only key."
"Yes, and of the two of us, you are the only one sweating. You'll be surprised at what I know. How many Clax Towers have come back out of the ground like mushrooms? And I know what the Ankh Morpork dwarfs are saying. You want to know? They say, why don't we have the Scone of Stone in Ankh Morpork? After all, there are more dwarfs in Ankh Morpork than there are in Schmalzberg. You would countenance our scone in that wretched place.
Of course not. But neither will I see you on the Scone of Stone. Your Grags are losing their followers. Not just because of the Clax Towers, and not because of Ankh Morpork, but because new generations arise and think, what's all this about? How can our parents be so stupid? And you can't stop people any more than you could stop the train.
Albrechtsen was almost sorry for Ardent now. You could live in denial for a long time, but like a snake, it doubles back and strikes.
You should face facts, Albrecht Albrechtsen. You'll be amazed at my support. Dwarfs must remain dwarfs, not simulacrums of humans. To follow Rhys Reeson is to become Dirkza, a half-dwarf, less than that even.
No, it is your kind of thinking that makes dwarfs small, wrapped up in themselves, declaring that any tiny change in what is thought to be dwarf is somehow sacrilege. I can remember the days when even talking to a human was forbidden by idiots such as you. And now you have to understand it's not about the dwarfs or the humans or the trolls. It's about the people. And that's where the troublesome Lord Veterinari wins the game. In Ankh Morpork, you can be whoever you want to be. And sometimes people laugh, and sometimes they clap. And mostly, and beautifully, they don't really care. Do you understand this? Dwarves have now seen liberty, and that's heady stuff.
Ardent almost spat and said,
You say that when you're known to be one of the biggest traditionalists in all the mines. I still am. And most of our traditions were to keep us safe, just in the way that the Grags, in their great heavy clothing, exploded the fire damp so that we wouldn't be burned alive. The rules of the mine. They learned the hard way, and the traditions are there for a purpose. They work. But somehow, you and the others don't realise that outside the caverns the world is different. Oh, I keep the special days and knock twice on every door and follow all the tenets attack. And why? Because they bring us together, as did the Clax Towers, until your blessed Delvis started to burn them. Burning words dying in the sky, is that to be the legacy of the dwarfs?
He stopped. Ardent had gone pale and seemed to be shivering. But then his eyes blazed, and he snarled.
You won't be driven, Albrecht, and nor will I. Train or no train. It'll never get here anyway. The world is not ready for locomotion.
He glared at Albrecht, who said,
Yes, of course it isn't. But what you don't understand is that the world wasn't ready for the Clax, but now it screams if they're burned down. And I believe that locomotion has not finished with us yet.
The response was the slamming of the door and the turning of the key. And now the fool had locked him in for the night, just where he wanted to be. There were guards, Albrecht knew, but like guards everywhere, they tended to slumber or go off somewhere to smoke a pipe during the longer hours of the night, and in any case, very few of them came near to this particular dungeon, since sensible guards didn't want to upset someone like Albrecht. Even if you thought you were on the right side, you never knew who the winner would be, and in those circumstances, smaller fry might be the ones to get fried. After a while, Albrecht picked up the little spoon with which he had eaten his meal, and there was the subtle scratching of rock dust which led to the appearance of a goblin, who grinned at him in the gloom.
Here you are, squire. Here's Clax Flimsies, fresh from Command of Imes, and a bottle of oil for lamp. Oh, and toothpaste you asks for. I've been told to tell you that train is moving like no one business. Sure to be here on schedule.
It was a kind of therapy to hear of the inevitable approach of the famous Iron Girder day after day. The aroma of a goblin, Albrecht thought, seemed to be a metaphysical one. After the initial shock, you had to wonder if the goblin smell was somehow arriving inside your head as much as through your nostrils. It wasn't even all that bad. It had the savour of old sculleries and southernwood. He took the packages and scanned the flimsies with the speed of a dwarf who had learned to assimilate the written word quickly. And he spoke with interest to the young goblin, a caste he had hitherto dismissed as a waste of space at best and a nuisance otherwise. But they seemed to be more level-headed than most of his fellow dwarfs, especially that fool Ardent, and it was amazing how they could get about in the darkness of Schmalzberg and make use of every rat hole before making use of the rat. And this one waited patiently while Albrecht sorted out some flimsies of his own to go back to the locomotive. And then the old dwarf did something else that surprised him. He said, "What's your name, young goblin? And may I beg your pardon for not inquiring earlier? Please forgive an old dwarf who hasn't kept up with the times." The goblin looked stunned and said, "Well, Gov, if it don't hurt anything, I am the Rattle of the Wheels. Railwaymen Friends is calling me Rat for short name. That makes all this very annoy." Albrecht held out a hand. The Rattle of the Wheels stepped back and then came forward sheepishly. "Nice to meet you, Rattle of the Wheels. Have you any family?" "Yes, your worship. My mother is of the happiness, the heart. Father is of the sky, the rim. And small brother is of the water, the crane." And after a moment the goblin said, "Actually, sir, you can stop holding my hand." "Oh, yes. I suppose that my name should be Of the Moment, the Stupefied. Good luck to you and your family. You know, in a way, I'm jealous of you. And now I've finished my work for the day, I'd like you to take my paperwork, such as it is, and hide it somewhere around here where no dwarf is going to look."
"We cleans toilets, sir. Knows plenty many places that not visited. Same time tomorrow."
The handshake fulfilled, the goblin disappeared into a hole that even a rat might find difficult to get into. And as the sounds of the goblin scrabbling through the hole faded away, Albrecht thought, "I would never have done that before. What a fool I was." Mrs. Gwendolyn Avery of Schmarm awoke in the middle of the night to the shaking and rattle of the multiple bottles of age-defying unguents on her dresser. And then she realised that the whole house was shaking to a rhythmic thudding. When she described this episode in dramatic tones to her friend Daphne the following morning, she said that it was like the sound of a lot of men marching past. She put it down to the cherry brandy she had had before going to bed, whilst Daphne, knowing Gwendolyn's regrettable spinster status, put it down to wishful thinking. The Slake Ranges were half tundra, half desert, mostly windswept. In short, a fossil of a landscape where nothing generally grew but stumbleweed. Stumbleweed is like tumbleweed but less athletic. This tells you everything you need to know about Slake. And the occasional gregarious pine, the nuts of which were said to be an antidote to melancholy. There was water, oh yes, but mostly underground, and prospectors and rock hounds were said to send down buckets to dredge water from the depths of the caves. It was slightly easier to find water on the uplands hubwards of the tundra, where there were icy streams courtesy of the Everwind Glacier, making it possible to raise goats there. And so goats were what young Nutt's family had bred and milked and minded down the centuries. And when the goats were eating what passed as grass on these highlands, he would sleep and dream of not chasing goats over a near barren landscape. He had liked it at first, but he was growing older, and something was telling him that there was a better life than watching goats eat their lunch. Once, twice, and sometimes thrice. Sometimes the faces they made were an entertainment, and sometimes he laughed. And yet a yearning in him told him that goats were not enough. And so it was when the long sound echoed across the tundra that he hurried to see what was making the wonderful noise and saw a shining streak snaking its way over the landscape in the early morning light, and it was heading his way. He wondered if it was anything to do with the strange bars of metal laid carefully on the tundra below by the gangs of men some weeks before. He had run errands for them and sold them his mother's cheese, but he couldn't really understand what it was they were doing, and since the goats stepped carefully over the metal strips without harm, he'd given up wondering. But as far as he could make out from what the men had said, it was all for a wondrous thing that could go around the world on a flash of steam. And now he wanted to know more about this singing beast, coming over the tundra, occasionally spitting fire. Nutt scrambled down off the hillside to where the air was warmer, leaving the goats, and ultimately traced the noise to a kind of big shed. And just as he got to it, the creature, carrying people inside it, broke out of the shed and hurtled away along the metal rails. He watched it until it had entirely disappeared. And later, some of the townspeople told him it was what they called a locomotive, and in his heart the yearning started and began by degrees to grow. Yes, there truly were other things than goats. Having spent a long afternoon and evening alert for anything untoward while Simnel and his lads lay dead to the world, Moist, in his turn, had slept soundly all night and now dozed right through the morning, rocked by the motion of the train as she steamed on from Slake across the valley of the Smarl, dreaming of the bridge over the gorge at the Willinus Pass. Never a picnic at any time, that was looming up fast like a tax demand. Anything could happen before they entered that dry land maelstrom of sliding rocks, falling rocks, and, well, rocks full of bandits of all disciplines. To coin a term that might fit the circumstances, it was like running a gauntlet with no shoes, a gauntlet full of rocks, and even pebbles had bad attitudes at that altitude. Moist winced at the thought of the place. The train hurtled on through the vast landscape. A huge amount of space, oh yes, but not many towns, just the occasional settlement. There was so much space everywhere, and Iron Girder ate it up like a tiger, attacking the horizon as if it were an affront, stopping only if it was known that water and coal were available. You could never have too much of either. By the middle of the day, the mountain ranges of Überwald were getting closer, and the air was getting colder, and Iron Girder's pace had settled to a steady climb through the foothills towards their destination. Lonely goat herds could be seen on the trackside, and amongst the people staring at this new mechanism, there was a definite outbreak of dirndls. In every township they passed, people were ready for them with flags and, above all, with bands that wheezed and umpired as the crowds cheered Iron Girder on her way. And yes, as the train came past slowly and carefully, you had to watch out for the little boys running after her, following the dream. It was a sight to yodel for. And now Moist noticed that Simnel was looking increasingly worried and took the opportunity of one of the engineer's rare breaks from the footplate to speak to him privately. "Dick, Iron Girder is the best locomotive you've ever built, right?" Simnel wiped his hands on a rag that had already seen too many greasy hands and said, "She surely is, Mr. Litvig. We all know that, but it's not Iron Girder I'm fretting about. It's that bridge over at Gorge. We've done everything we can, but we need more time. There's no way the bridge will hold with all the weight of the train and all." "Well now," said Moist, "you have the loggy sticks and the knowledge of the weights and the stresses, and all the other sliding rule business, and that's telling you one thing, but I'm telling you now that if the bridge is still not secure when we get there, I propose that Iron Girder will fly across the gorge with you and me on the footplate. You might call it a sleight of hand, even a trick, but we will fly." The engineer looked like a man who has been challenged to guess under which thimble the pea is, and knows deep in his boots that it will never, ever be the one he selects. "Mr. Litvig, are you talking about magic here? I'm an engineer, I am. We don't all wear magic." And suddenly Moist's voice was as smooth as treacle. "Actually, Mr. Simnel, I think you're wrong in that. You believe in the sunshine, although you don't know how it does it. And since we're on or near the subject, have you ever wondered what the turtle stands on?" Dick was cornered and said, "Hey, well, that's different. That's just how things are meant to be." "Pardon me, my friend, but you don't know that. Nevertheless, you go to bed at night quite happy in the belief that the world will still be there when you get up in the morning." Once again, Dick tried to get a grip on the proceedings, still wearing the look of a man certain that whichever thimble was going to be picked up, it wouldn't be his. A given in the scheme of things. "So we're talking about wizards then, Mr. Litvig?"
"Well, magic," said Moist. "Everything is magic when you don't know what it is. Your sliding rule is a magic wand to most people, and I know some kinds of magic. And so I'll ask you, Dick, have I ever let you down in any way during our time on Harry King's business?"
"Oh, no, Mr. Litvig," said Simnel, almost affronted. "I see you as what my old granny called full of fizz."
Moist caught the fizz in the air and juggled it.
"There you are, Dick. I believe you when you say that the numbers on the sliding rule are telling you things. In return, I'd like some trust from you. No, please don't use your sliding rule for this. It's the wrong tool for the job. I know something. Not exactly magic, but extremely solid. And with what I have in mind, by the time we get to the bridge, you'll think we're riding through the air."
Simnel once again looked as if he was about to cry.
"But why won't you tell me?"
"I could," said Moist, "but Lord Vetinari would have me dead."
"Eh, we can't have that, Mr. Litvig," said Simnel, shocked.
Moist put an arm round Simnel and said, "Dick, you can perform miracles, but I propose to give the world a spectacle that'll be remembered for a very long time."
"Hey, oh, Mr. Lipvig, I'm just an engineer."
"Not just an engineer, Dick. The engineer." And, as Simnel cherished that thought, he smiled nervously and said,
"But how? There just isn't enough time, and there aren't enough men neither. Harry King has brought out all his heavy-duty workers in the city and the planes, so I don't know where you'll get more support from."
"Well," said Moist, "I'll have to be like Iron Girder. I'll just whistle." Simnel laughed nervously.
"Hey, Mr. Lipvig, you're a sharp one."
"Good," said Moist, with a confidence he wasn't entirely feeling. "We should be ready by dusk." Just then Iron Girder let loose a little bit of steam, and Moist wondered if it was a good omen or possibly a bad one, but it seemed to him to be an omen anyway, and that was enough. That afternoon, in an attempt to distract his thoughts, Moist decided to tackle something that had been niggling at the back of his mind ever since they had left Stowe Lat, and for that he needed to talk to Aaron. The King's secretary was slim for a dwarf, almost nimble and quick, and decidedly ubiquitous, his long beard following him like a banner as he went about on the King's business. He carried a sword, not traditionally a dwarf weapon, and had acquitted himself well during the attack on the train at the Paps of Scylla. Choosing his moment carefully, Moist waylaid Aaron in a place where they could talk privately. "Mr. Secretary, I have to ask whether all is quite as it seems with the Low King." Aaron's eyes narrowed, and his hand went to the hilt of his sword.
"Of course it is. What a ridiculous question. Treacherous, too."
Moist put his hand out placatingly. "Look, you know I'm on your side. I have to ask because of something I saw at Mrs. Simnel's house." Aaron looked startled and said,
"I believe the side you're on is your own, sir, and whatever you think you saw, it's certainly no business of yours."
"Indeed it is, my friend," Moist replied. "The gods, for my sins, gave me a nose for scenting when the metaphorical shit is about to hit the windmill, and I want to be prepared." Aaron stood frozen, and without looking directly at Moist, he said,
"Your perspicacity does you credit, Mr. Lipvig. Your silence, even more."
"Oh, come on. There's something going on here, and I'm not in on it. Don't force me to draw my own conclusions. I do have a very big pencil." But Aaron clearly had nothing further to say. The appearance of a couple of engineers at the end of the carriage provided the excuse he needed for bringing the conversation to an abrupt close. He turned on his heel and marched smartly off down the corridor, leaving Moist with every suspicious nerve in his body jangling.